afterward. It would have simplified things for my publishers and me if the fifth book of Earthsea had been a novel, but it wasn't. Sometimes the elements of a book won't come together into a single story, being by nature disparate. They have to go different places, different ways. One back through the centuries, another to Havnor, maybe, another to Semmel. I couldn't write the last Earthsea novel until I'd been to islands and times that I hadn't yet explored. Storytellers' stories, like scientific theories, are explorations, excursions into the tremendous gap between almost knowing and knowing. Bridges thrown out as a spider throws herself on her first long anchoring thread, not certain where it will land her, yet trusting it to do so. I love no music better than the uncertain beginning of the last movement of Beethoven's Last Symphony, when he starts a theme and drops it, repeats a phrase and breaks off, leaves gaps, gropes, explores, till he bursts out with his frustration in words, "Oh, friends, this isn't right yet." Footnote. "O Freunde, nicht diese Töne." That means, "O friends, not these notes," or "not this music." "This isn't right yet" is free translation from the heart. And then it all begins to come together, and the bridge has crossed the void. I wrote an introduction for Tales from Earthsea when it was published in 2001, which began this way. At the end of the fourth book of Earthsea, Tahanu, the story had arrived at what I felt to be now. And, just as in the now of the so-called real world, I didn't know what would happen next. I could guess, foretell, fear, hope, but I didn't know. Unable to continue Tahanu's story because it hadn't happened yet, and foolishly assuming that the story of Ged and Tanar had reached its happily ever after, I gave the book a subtitle, The Last Book of Earthsea. Oh, foolish writer. Now moves. Even in story time, dream time, once upon a time, now isn't then. 7 or 8 years after Tahanu was published, I was asked to write a story set in Earthsea. A mere glimpse at the place told me that things had been happening there while I wasn't looking. It was high time to go back and find out what was going on now. For the whole story of Earthsea to have weight and make sense in my own mind so that I could take it to its end, so that I could build the bridge to true closure, not only did I have to find out what was going on now, but I had to go back in time to find out what had gone wrong, and when, and how. Why had the wise teaching of the balance been getting increasingly out of balance? People who live immersed in the ceaseless present tense of electronic media may have no interest in the past, letting mythology replace history as preliterate peoples did. But as I grew up with the unrearrangeable, implacable durability of print, my education gave me the sense of the past that perceives the present as only the bright, restless surface of an ocean. So, paradoxical as it may seem, I didn't want a mythology of my mythical world, but the history of it, the facts of the fiction, its time depths, which of course meant, yet more paradoxically, that I had to make it up. To grope, blunder, see if it worked. Oh, friends, this isn't right yet. The description of Earthsea at the end of the tales is a summary sketch of that history as I worked it out while writing the stories. The first novella, The Finder, is the prequel, the story behind the story of the first four books of Earthsea. Writing it really was like swinging out on a spider thread into the unknown. I had no clear idea where young Otter was going when he set out into his dark, misgoverned world. I knew only that he would come to Roke and found the school there. By following him, I hoped to learn, for one thing, how it came to be that the wizards of Roke, as I first knew them, had renounced their sexuality and how much of their humanity they had renounced with it. All the stories are explorations of such matters, unclarities, balances and imbalances, moral choices. Dark Rose and Diamond again has to do with the question of wizardly celibacy and also asks the question, if you could either do magic or make songs, but not both, which might you choose and why? In The Bones of the Earth, I found out who Ogeon was, who his teacher was, and how far magic could and could not go. On the High Marsh, let me deal with what gets left out when magic is understood purely as power. Power over whom and to do what? Save the world from your enemies? Is that all? Is it enough? If power is responsibility, for whom are you responsible? In this story, as in T.H. White's Sword in the Stone and many other fantasies, the presence of animals disallows wholly human-centered conventions, hinting at a different, larger order of things. The last novella, Dragonfly, is the direct bridge between Tehanu and the final novel. Its final events follow after the end of Tehanu and come before The Other Wind. Everything I'd been learning about the relationship of people and dragons begins to come clear in this story, along with the understanding of what had gone wrong on Roke. I was beginning to hear the great final themes of the whole story of Earthsea. It was beginning to come right. In the original foreword, I said, in the years since I began to write about Earthsea, I've changed, of course, and so have the people who read the books. All times are changing times, but ours is one of massive, rapid moral and mental transformation. Archetypes turn into millstones. Large simplicities get complicated. Chaos becomes elegant. And what everybody knows is true turns out to be what some people used to think. It's unsettling. For all our delight in the impermanent, the entrancing flicker of electronics, we also long for the unalterable. We cherish the old stories for their changelessness. Arthur dreams eternally in Avalon. Bilbo can go there and back again, and there is always the beloved, familiar Shire. Don Quixote sets out forever to kill a windmill. We may, I said, turn to fantasy seeking stability, ancient truths, immutable simplicities. But the realms of once upon a time are unstable, mutable, complex, and as much a part of human history and thought as the nations in our ever-changing atlases. And in daily life or in imagination, we don't live as our parents or ancestors did. Enchantment alters with age and with the age. We know a dozen different Arthurs now, all of them true. The Shire changed irrevocably even in Bilbo's lifetime. Don Quixote went riding out to Argentina and met Jorge Luis Borges there. To this I add, as the virtual world of electronic communication becomes the world many of us inhabit all the time, in turning to imaginative literature, we may not be seeking mere reassurance, nor be impelled by mere nostalgia. To enter with heart and mind into the world of the imagination may be to head deliberately and directly toward, or back toward, engagement with the real world. In one of T.S. Eliot's poems, a bird sings, "Mankind cannot bear very much reality." I've always thought that bird was mistaken, or was talking only about some people. I find it amazing how much of the real world most of us can endure, not only endure, but need, desire, crave. Reality is life. Where we suffocate is in the half-life of unreality, untruth, imitation, fakery, the almost true that is not true. To be human is to live both within and beyond the narrow band of what happens now, in the vast regions of the past and the possible, the known and the imagined. Our real world. Our true now. Ursula K. Le Guin.